Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. This is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas. Robert, I've got a burning question for you.
All right, fire off.
I would like to know if you have ever tasted hufu.
Hufu. I'm not sure I know what that is.
Well, I hope that you're going to say no.
Okay.
Because, well, it's non-existent, actually. So that's the first thing.
Okay.
Because otherwise, I would worry a little bit if you said yes. It's actually a spoof product, and it was supposedly supposed to be a soy-based food product designed to resemble human flesh in taste and texture.
Hmm.
And so the website, it was up for about a year, maybe 2005, 2006. And it had all these great products that you just never could buy. So if you wanted, you know, if you were really wanting a finger or an arm or something, but didn't necessarily want to cannibalize someone, you could, in theory, order this.
So did they replicate? Really. They replicated the taste or the form?
The taste and the texture.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, if you really get logical about it, I'm not sure there's anything that weird about it. Not compared to say, well, okay, you're a vegetarian, right?
Yes.
Okay. Do you ever have like soysage or like a soy dog or, you know, or any kind of, tofurkey or whatever?
Yeah, I have like meat simulated products.
Well, see, like that seems like, I mean, it's not unlike that. You don't want to actually eat meat, but you're okay with something that
and yet,
resembles the taste. And
yeah. And form. Yet there's a disconnect because sometimes when I pull out a piece of what's supposed to be bacon and I look at it and it's a little disconcerting.
Yeah.
So I'm frying up the bacon and yet I don't eat bacon and I don't necessarily want bacon.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have to say there is that bacon taste that you can never really replicate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even if you're frying up some soy bacon, it is going to look like bacon and not say like a pig's face. Like you can't get a soy pig face, right? Maybe you can. Maybe it's a special order thing, but it's going to be a small
Asian market that may actually carry that.
Oh wow!
They do some pretty funky stuff with it.
So, this you know, in discussing like why is this creepy and this not, you know, with the hufu. I mean, that really comes down to the basic question about cannibalism in nature as a whole,
right?
Because it's one of those things when you really look at it. There's kind of like the animal version, and then. Well, there's really only the animal version.
But we hope.
Yes. Well, but on top of the animal version, and this is like, you know, as cannibalism relates to just any kind of creature you might find that practices it, and a lot of animals practice it. If you layer human culture and human society and our complex web of emotions and values on top of that, it just really complicates the matter. And you get into this area where cannibalism is really this, I mean, it's just, you know, it's an outrageous thing. It's like it raises outrage from people.
For us who like to think that we have morals and social values and we all cooperate with each other. We try not to eat each other.
Yeah.
Humans. Yeah.
Yeah. I found this great quote from Tom Sorrell from the University of Birmingham. And he said, quote, "In intellectual history, cannibals stand for alien and exotic human beings, specimens of our species who realize its darkest possibilities, usually in places far removed from civilization. Cannibalism both expresses natural law and contravenes it." So.
Right. So yeah. There's the rub, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it happens in nature and it's perfectly natural there, right?
Yeah,
and yet we can't help but wince a little bit.
Yeah. You hear, but you know, if you start hearing that somebody's like, you know, grinding up corpses, you know, to serve in the restaurant, people just get outraged. There's a great Monty Python skit where it involves like grinding up corpses and feeding it to people. And it's like they break the fourth wall and like the audience just starts throwing things. You know, it's that outrageous a concept.
Right. Right.
You
want to know where your meat pie came from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's very, like I say, it's very widespread in the animal kingdom, and it is a major mortality factor in the biology of numerous species. So we're going to sort of walk through we're not really going to go with pros and cons, but first of all, we're going to look at the case for cannibalism in nature and some of the ways that it's practiced. And then we're going to look at the case against. And for the most part, we're going to avoid the whole question of cannibalism within the larger human institution. But we do have an excellent article on the website by Josh Clark about that. So I highly recommend checking that out if you want to get more into the, you know, the serial killer cannibal topics.
Right, or endocannibalism.
Yeah.
All the different types of cannibalism that exists.
All right, so the big thing for me when I was researching this is that a lot of it really comes down to energy. Right.
Right.
Because if you're an organism on this planet, unless you're a plant that's generating a lot of its energy from through photosynthesis, and even that, you're not all the energy is necessarily coming from the sun. But for the rest of us, we're having to consume other little bundles of energy to keep our energy going. So we're having to eat other organisms. Now we might not eat, you know, we might only eat plants, or we might only eat animals. But we're having to eat something. So it's this constant, this is this huge pyramid, you know, of predators preying on other forms of energy.
Right. And even bugs. Let's not discount bugs. Some people eat bugs and they like them quite a bit.
They're supposedly quite good. I've never had one. Have you had a bug?
No, but I think it's a street food in Vietnam.
Yeah. There was supposedly some in Thailand. I didn't get to try it when I was there.
Yeah, it's supposed to be incredibly nutritious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd try it if I had the chance, but it's never offered on, you know, the local menus.
No, it's not.
Here in Atlanta. Where are the palmetto bug salads? I don't know.
You'll have to start a food truck based on that.
So like we said, it all comes down to energy. It comes down to predation. And cannibalism is basically a pet predator-prey interaction within a species. So it's a member of this species preying on a member of another, of the same species.
Okay.
So like, you know, when you get into discussions of, did humans eat Neanderthals and did Neanderthals eat humans? That's not really cannibalism. It's kind of creepy, but it would be two different species eating each other.
Okay.
Or one, you know, that's a whole separate podcast there.
Okay.
But
it would be like me eating you.
Right.
Same species.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
But let's hope it doesn't come to that.
Right. So there are different types of cannibalism, right? So there's, something called siblicide.
Yes. This is most commonly seen in the sand tiger shark. This is a situation where the animal has two uteri and each one produces a number of eggs, but each litter yields just two pups, one for each uterus.
Okay. So there's some competitiveness there.
Yeah. These, the little embryos have embryonic teeth. So you have all these little, you know, unborn brothers and sisters in there, and it's kind of like a, it's like each one is like a battle royale of, you know, who's going to be the toughest. So it's like just kind of, you know, chomp down on each other. And at the end of it, you have one shark pup left standing.
Huh. Okay. And so they're hungry. They've got teeth. It actually reminds me of Dwight Schrute from The Office. I don't know if you ever watch it.
I do watch it. I don't remember the quote.
Yeah, he said that he actually absorbed his own twin brother, so he therefore had the strength of a man and a baby.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I guess it would be like the Dwight Schrutes of the animal world.
Yeah. Yeah, you could think of this as the Schrute factor.
Right.
So so these two sand tiger sharks end up emerging with the strength of... With a very shrewd-like veracity,
right,
to help them, you know, ensure their survival. Yeah, and approximately 14 species of shark are thought to practice some form of this cannibalism, but the sand tiger shark is the one that we've studied the most.
And, okay.
And we have the most down on. One of the things to keep in mind about procreation in the animal kingdom is that, especially sexual reproduction, it's like a huge energy, waste.
Yeah. Well,
not necessarily a waste, but let's say it's an investment, a huge investment. Because, just look at humans, for instance. Think of all the energy that goes into sexual selection. You know, whole products. You know, people, especially, you know, how much time do teenagers waste on sexual selection? Enormous amount of time. They don't know how they get anything done.
Indeed.
And,
how do they study?
I know. Apparently they don't. But, I don't know. I guess they do. But anyway, energy, for the sex act itself. Then there's, then on the mother's part, there's the energy to bring the offspring to term, the energy to give birth, and then the energy to raise the child till it can fend for itself.
Right.
Because remember, the genetic mission is basically create another, you know, another creature.
Replicate your DNA.
Replicate the DNA, keep that strain of DNA going, and then, you know, put this new, product on the market and let it, you know, carry on its own.
Right, right. And so all these niceties, like playing at, you know, Mozart in the uterus, aren't necessarily their focus.
Right.
Just get it out there, get it going.
But in a way, it's like, make sure it's like the best, you know, the best possible. And instead of eating the sharks in the womb, it's, you know, potentially listening to Mozart, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I also like to think of this in terms of like a business. Like if How Stuff Works were to launch like some sort of separate entity.
Okay.
Like, I don't know, How Crabs Work or something. Like, we were going to do a site that's just about crabs. And we're like, this is going to be, it's going to be like How Stuff Works, except it's only going to focus on crabs. It would be kind of like the company's offspring, right?
Okay. So it'd be like all crabs all the time, crab fashions, crab recipes, crab
right.
science.
But the existing business has a certain amount of energy already tied up into it.
Right.
A certain number of employees, right? So let's say, well, okay, we're going to have one employee go off to be the editor of this new site, and another to be the writer, another to be the marketing guy, another to be the, you know, the programmer, et cetera, all the things that can make it what it is. And it has to, and where it's like forming this new entity of itself, right?
Okay.
So it's this huge energy this huge energy investment. And if that doesn't work, then one of two things are going to happen. Either all those people are going to lose their jobs, or they're going to be absorbed back into the parent company.
Okay.
Or at least that's my understanding.
They're going to be shrewded.
Yeah, they're going to be shrewded.
Okay.
So, That leads us to another type of cannibalism that's very common, and that's the eating of one's own young.
Yeah.
Which, again, is one of these kind of, like, terrifying type of things. There's the classic image. Is it Cronus, the god?
Of time?
Yeah, eating his own son.
I think so.
Yeah. I'm a little shaky on this particular story from mythology, but there's a famous painting of it, and there's, I think, Zeus, like, was able to, like, somebody snuck Zeus away by putting a rock in there so that he would eat the rock instead of baby Zeus.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because Zeus was all about killing the young, his young.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's another sort of terrifying idea, you know, that oh my goodness, the mother is the life bringer. And then, you know, and if you've ever had hamsters or any other, you know, kind of animal like that that ends up killing its young and or mm-hmm. eating them, it can be kind of a terrifying moment. But it makes a lot of sense from an energy standpoint.
Right, from a survival
right.
basic.
Yeah, energy has been expended to create these new creatures, and there are calories wrapped up in them, so you bring them back into the fold, right?
Right, okay. Well, I'm actually thinking, too, sort of related to that, there's the masked booby, which is a bird.
Whoa, what?
Yes. I knew it. I knew I couldn't just say masked booby.
Yeah, you've got to run these by me and
I've got to give you a hint there. Okay. But okay, so getting that aside, the masked booby is actually a bird, and it's indigenous to the Galapagos Islands. And that's a case where the parents, it's a case of sib eating, right?
Okay.
There are two siblings. But that's a case where the parents actually step in and they encourage them to kill one of the other off.
Whoa.
Yeah. And they actually, the odds are stacked, in favor of their eldest. So it's sort of like, akin to getting them into a match and seeing, like a chicken fight and seeing who's going to come out best. And the reason for that is the very same, which is, you know, you want to put all your effort into the sibling that's going to survive and has the best chance of carrying on. It sounds harsh, but it comes back to that.
So anybody out there that is in kind of a Bluth family type situation where they feel like their mom and or dad are stirring competition up, just be glad that they're not encouraging you to kill and eat each other.
That's right. Be glad that you're not a masked booby.
Yes. But just to give you an idea of how many different animals engage in this, and it's also for instance, sharks will practice the eating. They'll end up eating eggs that haven't been fertilized.
Yeah.
And sometimes eggs will be eaten that have been fertilized. But you'll see this form of cannibalism in protozoa, slime molds, sea slugs, insects, spiders, fish, reptiles. They've observed it in dinosaur fossils. Bats, seals, sea lions, otters, polar bears, even otters. Yes.
Otters.
They're cute.
Little otters.
Yeah. Imagine one, cannibalizing another.
I won't.
Or eating its young. It happens. It never shows up in the cute pictures, but, tigers, chimpanzees, amphibians, at least 100 species of mammals, in all. And of course, hamsters.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. They're most known for it. Don't tap on the glass. which leads us to, some of the reasons. Why would a mother hamster suddenly decide that she needs to slay all her offspring and eat some of them?
I don't know. Maybe she had way too many.
And exactly.
That's too much energy to expend.
Right.
On a broad that big.
Yeah. It's kind of like if you, to use the sort of clunky business analogy from earlier, it's like if you suddenly created this enormous side project with way too many employees, you're like, whoa, this is going to fail. This doesn't make sense. It's not going to bring in enough money on its own to support that.
Right.
So we gotta bring some, if not all of these employees back into the fold.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of them too, if they're born with, a disease
mm-hmm.
or they're not quite up to par, isn't that another reason to sort of cull down the brood is to take out the ones that are the weakest and use them for energy for everybody else.
Yeah, like female rattlesnakes, for instance, will consume on average about 11% of their postpartum mass. Mostly, these are going to be stillborn or just non-viable offspring. So again, it's like they have all these offspring. It's all about like let's keep the species going, let's keep the DNA going.
Yeah,
you're going to want to invest in the ones that are the best candidates.
I mean, you know, it's disgusting to us, but it really is practical if you think about it.
Yeah.
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 If you take the anthropomorphic-ness out of it.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's the basic mission, the genetic mission, and the energy logic tied to it. And if you strip away all the layers that human culture has put on top of it, then it makes perfect sense.
You know, just as a side observation or question, I was thinking about this and I was thinking about mammals who eat their placentas after birth.
Uh huh.
And I'm wondering if they ever cannibalize their young. If maybe
they just get kind of carried away.
Well, no, I'm wondering if maybe the eating the placenta actually serves the need of eating some sort of protein and getting some energy source back.
Huh.
And instead of eating their young, they eat their placenta.
I think it would make perfect sense.
I don't know. Yeah. That's a question. If anybody knows the answer to that would love to know.
Yeah. Another great example of this comes in invasive cane toads in Australia. And these are just some crazy animals because you'll have small and medium sized, but not large cane toads, and they'll wave a long middle toe off their hind foot up and down in the water, and they're doing this to catch other toads, and then the cane toad larva will actively seek out toad eggs of the same species to eat. So there's just like a lot of cannibalism going on in cane toads. In fact, and again, they're invasive and they're a huge problem in Australia. And they found a 2010 study found that this was actually encouraging them to spread, because a mother toad would end up wanting to lay her eggs in a virgin a pond or a little stream or whatever, just to encourage. Just to protect it from other cane toads.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's like, it just ends up, we got to find new water to for these eggs to develop in, so they're not eaten by all the other cane toads. But they think that that they might be able to draw the chemical that, the eggs shed, that attracts the other cane toads and use that as some sort of a bait.
Like a pheromone or something similar to that. I just can't get over the image of like all these toes pointing up in the water like synchronized swimmers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm sure that's happening.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
So yeah, we could keep going and just listing all sorts of weird and grotesque examples of mothers eating their own young, but we should probably move on into another fascinating area of cannibalism, and definitely a sexier area of cannibalism, sexual cannibalism.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Which sounds like a great name for a band if it is not used already. To draw back to an example that we brought up in a previous podcast, or one about Ladies' Night on Planet Earth, about the role that the male has in any given species.
Right.
We mentioned the brown Antechinus, which is also known as McLehey's marsupial mouse. And this is the male that mates for 12 hours at a time and eventually humps himself to death. And then he's not another mouth to feed through the winter.
Right.
Like the species can then just focus on, mother raising the young. All the men are dead. Until next season.
Yeah, I think maybe I said that he was that sort of relegated to like being the pool boy.
Yeah.
For the female.
So that being the case, sexual cannibalism occurs when the female eats her mate during or immediately after the sex act.
Which happens a lot.
Yeah.
Apparently.
And again, it's like if you look at the male as merely a mutation necessary for a sexual reproduction. He doesn't necessarily have a lot of use after that sexual encounter. So again, that's energy that's just wasted. So it reminds me of like when a company brings on contract workers for a project that has a short-term goal.
Yes.
They're like, we need to get this project done, but we don't want to like hire six guys and then have to pay them and gals and have to pay them benefits, et cetera.
Right.
So let's just bring them on as contract workers. And then in 6 months, we're done. So it's kind of like the male in these cases, it's a contract worker. And when they're not needed anymore, they're let go.
And they're submitting themselves to this process willingly because they want to make sure that their offspring survive. Is that the idea behind this?
What, the mating?
Yeah.
Well,
that they would say, okay, yeah, I will mate with you knowing that you're going to, say, you're a praying mantis. You're going to rip my head off and then consume me as I'm mating you.
Well, it's interesting. I was reading some stuff about this, and in most cases, the male's going to mate. That's, am I right, ladies? The male is, that's the male's mission.
Right.
So he's going to engage in that. But you'll also see, like with praying mantises, the males will try and survive, within, their limited ability to do so. And it's also, it's kind of exaggerated in most praying mantises, mm-hmm. I understand, because a lot of the early, studies into this, you had females in captivity who had not eaten as much as they'd want to.
So it's kind of like they were voracious.
Yeah, they were voracious.
They're ripping
hungry.
Off heads.
Yeah, and so here's right and this this mantis, and he's done his part or is doing his part, and he can continue doing his part generally pretty well even with his head eaten off.
Mm-hmm.
So they just go for it. They say that typically praying mantis cannibalistic mating process only occurs 5 to 31% of the time, and it occurs most often if the female is hungry.
Okay.
Yeah. And so most species are only going to cannibalize regularly in captivity. But there's one species, the mantis religiosa, which is really into it. And it's necessary that the head be removed for the mating process to take effect properly. So, and in these cases, the female typically eats a third of her partners. And she eats even more in the lab if the male can't escape.
Okay.
But that's the thing. The male will try and escape. It's just, you know, a third of the time he doesn't have a chance.
Yeah, I think it was the mantises I was reading about that there was some suggestion that they had evolved to sort of almost create a belt-like effect in their abdomen region, mm-hmm. so that they were drawing in all of their major organs as tightly inward as possible so that the fangs wouldn't get to them very easily.
So they can keep processes going at least to complete the
Yeah, exactly. So they can mate longer without dying. But it's interesting. I was actually thinking about this too. Harvard biologist Stephen Jay Gould, he had thought that that it wasn't as widespread as it actually we know it is now. Mm-hmm. And his idea was that...
Are you saying sexual cannibalism or cannibalism in general?
Sexual cannibalism. I think it must have been very troubling to him because he sort of came up with all these different ideas about it. But the main crux of it was that maybe it wasn't as widespread as it actually is, and that the female had just mistaken her mate as prey, which I thought was really funny. Because, I mean, moments before, the praying mantis was, you know, filling his wings and showing his abs, his six-pack, and, you know, then began mating with her. And the idea that she just sort of forgot what she was doing and turned around and went, whoa, prey.
Wow. Maybe, you know, maybe he just had like a really horrible, you know, girlfriend at some point. And he was like, wow, like somebody that just like snaps at the, you know, and so he was like, all women must be like this, regardless of species.
It's possible. there's definitely some overreaching there.
Now there's one, you'll find sexual cannibalism in a number of arachnids and insects, but it's particularly interesting in the redback spider.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. This is a relative of the black widow. And the males, first of all, are really tiny. Like, it's one of these cases where the whole case for males is just being a mutation necessary to procreation and not being the species itself.
Right.
Really opposite. I mean, really, it's really obvious in this particular species because the male is just tiny. It looks like an entirely different animal.
Okay.
The female is enormous, and the male is a willing participant in the sexual cannibalism. All right, so during copulation, this the little male guy, he'll position himself above the female's jaws. All right, and basically like shove himself into her jaws so that she gets to eat him. And they believe that it's favored in sexual selection because the cannibalized spiders received two different advantages. First of all, cannibalized males copulate longer and fertilize more eggs than those that survive.
Okay.
And then also, the females were more likely to reject subsequent suitors if they consumed a mate. So,
this makes sense. I think they were talking about it as a sort of like, a sperm plug.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not to get racy about it or anything, but basically that, you know, they had made their deposit and that, you know, any other males after that wouldn't necessarily be successful.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting because like we're looking at these other cases of sexual cannibalism and the male really doesn't necessarily have any, there's no argument for the male sticking around and being eaten for the, you know, the advancement of the species and the, and him passing on his DNA. But this is a case where there's a definite advantage if he gives himself up to, you know, to the appetite of his mate.
Yeah. And I thought something that, was really dramatic that I read is that one account said that they actually somersault onto the fangs, which is like, take me, please eat me. And then the other thing that I read is that, during the mating process that they pluck the strings on the female's web for like 8 hours.
Oh.
I know. And I thought that is kind of sweet. But then I kind of thought, well, maybe she was like, God, that is driving me crazy. I'm going to eat you.
These guys are so nice. And then the lady spiders are so hard on them. It's just a...
I know. Yeah. It's a rough life. And then there's the orb weaving spider, orb weaving, in which the male sexual organ gets stuck in the female. And this is by design.
Okay.
Again, it's the same idea of a sort of a sperm plug. So although she can polish him off and, you know... snack on him, she's stuck with him, so to speak, and that just makes sure that she can't mate with someone else afterwards. So there's definite design behind this. I don't think that they're just being masochistic here.
Yeah, it's not the situation where the insect world is just like, you know, evil or anything.
No.
It all makes sense in the grand scheme of things. Now, moving away from sexual cannibalism, you'll also find plenty of animals that just seem to be kind of jerks, like kind of antisocial jerks.
Yeah.
And if they encounter anything, they're probably, you know, they're either going to run from it or try and kill it. And if it's one of their own, they're probably going to try and either mate with it or kill it or mate with it and kill it. So, various scorpions are great examples of this. Like scorpions tend to live very solitary lives. And, if they encounter another scorpion of the same variety, then there's a very good chance that that one will eat the other one. And if they're opposite sex and, and they see it as a good time to mate, then they may mate and then one will eat the other.
Wow. These guys are jerks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Komodo dragon is of course another great example of just being a cannibal just for the heck of it, because, the Komodo dragon young are just considered prey, up until they're a certain size.
So primarily raised for prey.
Well, not primarily raised for prey, but they're just the parents have no role in, mm-hmm. in rearing them after they've been born. So they just have to climb the trees to escape
Parents.
Yeah, to escape their parents. Otherwise, their parents will eat them. They're like, oh, look at those guys. They look tasty. I'm hungry. Let's do this. Interestingly enough, the one thing they can do to, besides hiding in the treetops, is if they smear themselves in excrement, then that will keep, their parents from potentially eating them.
That does actually work.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
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 Okay. Good.
Komodo dragon too. I remember something with Sharon Stone's husband some years back.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Didn't they dine on her husband's foot?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they went like a behind the scenes or something, and he went to go pet it.
Yeah.
That just seems like a bad idea.
Yeah, I understand it really scarred him. He's been, emotionally to the
right.
point where he always keeps himself smeared in Komodo excrement.
Excrement, yeah.
Especially on vacation.
I guess that's why their relationship didn't work out.
Yeah. And of course, you'll find plenty of cases where, animals of various form, will be more than willing to eat their own dead. After they've
right.
been killed by another, species. You know, alligator, crocodile comes across a dead, creature of the same species. It's food. They'll eat it. A number of scavengers, like vultures, et cetera. They see the food. They'll eat it. And even, humans, throughout history, you have situations where humans have eaten their own dead in cases of survival cannibalism.
Right.
Some of those cases are a little, controversial. Like, I've read cases for and against the Donner Party cannibalism thing actually happening.
Right, because there were no actual witnesses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you also have the case of the soccer team and Alive, and the actual events that movie and book were based on, where they're in a horrible situation.
Mm-hmm.
There are these dead bodies, and really on a very logical level, those bodies are energy, and if you're in a situation where it's life or death, you're going to consume that energy.
Right. And I think that's the important thing to think about, is that it really is in extreme conditions, right? In with humans, as it has happened, and in nature. I mean, food is scarce. But, you can always look over at someone and say, it would be a good protein source.
Yeah. And in nature, it tends to be it's a lot more life and death, obviously. Especially with these cases we're looking at in the ocean, where competition is tremendous.
Right.
And, I think a lot of our fascination with cannibalism is that it is, we largely, a lot of us anyway, live in a time where it's really hard to imagine such a desperate situation and that would necessitate this kind of return to our primal roots and our basic programming.
Yeah, actually, wasn't it Ted Turner who not too long ago warned everybody that we'd become cannibalists if we didn't address the global warming situation?
Oh, really? I missed that.
Yeah, yeah. There was, of course, it drew outrage, but
wow.
It was certainly a way to get people to pay attention to the problem.
I actually heard that the Ted's Montana Grills, they actually had these statues of people that they were going to start rolling out in place of the buffalo. If that cannibalism thing were, cause Ted's a savvy businessman. So
yeah.
If cannibalism becomes a new thing, then Ted's Montana Grill is going to pick up on it.
Yeah, of course. That's a brilliant idea. But what about primates? I mean, primates and cannibalism is one of those things I can't help but anthropomorphize, because I think that we look at them
mm-hmm.
and see so much of ourselves in them, and they do cannibalize one another from time to time.
Yeah. It's especially with primates, you see some very disturbing acts, you know, and they're more disturbing because they resemble us more.
Right.
And, you'll see chimpanzees, even gorillas and orangutans. There are cases where they're, you know, suspected of eating their own young. And we've seen plenty of cases of where chimpanzees have demonstrated their capacity for quote unquote cruelty, towards, other chimpanzees.
But will they, I know that sometimes when they're, fighting that they'll kill each other, but when they're fighting, they don't necessarily eat the body afterward. Is that right?
Right. Not necessarily will they eat it.
So it's more, I guess if they come along a deceased chimpanzee or other type of ape and they actually just eat it.
Yeah. In chimpanzees, typically the males will kill and eat the infant of another female, usually in their own group, but occasionally in another.
Okay.
And when chimps kill adults from other groups in a fight, they don't eat the body.
Okay. Yeah. And I remember this too, that they might eat the infant to force the chimpanzee into estrus so that they can go ahead and propagate again. Is that right?
I believe so. Yeah.
So the infant may not have been their infant, but they want to go ahead and mate and get the process rolling.
Right. Now, it's interesting when you start looking at primates eating one another in different cases, you know, throughout history. There are constantly studies arguing for and against the just how much cannibalism was going on with prehistoric humans. But anthropologist William Ahrens suggests it's simply a bad strategy as far as evolution goes, though. Like, since under evolutionary theory, we're fueled by that, you know, innate desire to see our genes survive, you know, eating another one of your, you know, your tribe and your species, that doesn't really make sense. You know, it's,
right.
It's working against our basic programming. And another interesting thing to keep in mind is, you may think, well, why don't humans just raise, you know, why don't humans raise humans for food, right? Or how come you don't have, cases where, cannibalism becomes a staple of any species diet? Though it is worth pointing out that, cannibalism can play a huge role in a diet. I think I'm going to go back to the scorpions here for a second. There was a 1980 study of desert scorpions, and they found that cannibalism provided only the fourth most common meal for a scorpion. But as far as body mass goes, it was the number one, representing more than 25% of its total food intake.
Okay.
So in the case of the scorpion, yes, cannibalism can provide a large part of its diet. But in humans, you see a different situation.
Yeah, in humans, nature does not necessarily like for us to practice cannibalism. And I think that you can see that pretty well illustrated in the Four tribe. Is that right? With the Kuru?
Yes, Kuru is it's a rare breed of disorder caused by what are called prions. And these are abnormal proteins which induce irregular protein folding in brain cells. And this leads to flawed brain tissue, which results in progressive, incurable brain damage. The word itself, Kuru, means laughing disease in its name because the scientists observed fits of hysterical laughing in those affected. So it's pretty traumatic stuff.
And so this came on because the tribe was basically practicing endocannibalism.
Right.
Is that right?
With
the funeral rites, they were consuming the body, which, you know, isn't because they were looking for a source of protein, but because it was a way to respect the deceased, to literally absorb them.
Right. And it's interesting. This is a case where if you start thinking about cannibalism in a very logical, you know, energy sort of, thing, then, eating one's ancestors does kind of makes sense. It's like a way to honor them. It's like I'm inviting their energy back into me. And that's pretty much how they look at it.
Would be great.
Yeah. Symbolically, it's great.
Yeah.
And on a basic energy level, it's not bad either. But the thing is, it's kind of, it really opens the door for the passage of, disease.
Right. And so this is sort of like the mad cow equivalent. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Mad cow is a similar disorder, as is, so I'm going to just take a shot at this, Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease.
Creutzfeldt?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah,
that sounds
go
better
that.
Than what I did. And this is a human variant of mad cow disease. And, they basically, like with the foray, they were basically able to, to wipe out the disease by simply getting them to stop practicing this communal cannibalism.
Right, like literally overnight.
Yeah.
They got them to eradicate this from the tribe.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically it's like, hey, guys, you know when your family members go stark raving mad and are laughing at nothing and then die? Well, that comes from the cannibalism, so let's cut that out.
It's they're pretty, like, what?
They're like, well, you know, we weren't that crazy about the cannibalism. we can set that aside.
Well, I guess it's also in nature a little bit of a concern for primates too, because they sometimes will consume a body as a group.
Right.
Spreading potentially a disease, something like hepatitis.
Right.
And I did want to add a side note about bonobos, mm-hmm. which is an ape, and they're sometimes called the hippie ape because they are fun-loving and they love to mate without discretion. It's like the key parties in the 70s.
Yeah, they are the bonobo along with the humans and the dolphins, only animals that actually enjoy sex.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, hence called the hippie ape. I don't know. Do hippie apes enjoy sex more than other apes? I don't know. But something that was pretty disconcerting is that they were observed pretty recently in the wild to have consumed one of their own. And again, this is the anthropomorphic thing where we look at them and we say, oh, but they're just peace-loving and they just love to have sex with each other. Why are they eating each other? But they would be a good example of primates taking the body and eating it. And they actually ate that body for more than 7 hours, which is a lot longer than they would take on any other body.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the people in the group, or the individuals, I guess you would say,
right.
not people, were actually playing with the food. So it's an interesting side note in that it's an odd occurrence for bonobos to be doing that, and in the way that they did. And of course, you could extrapolate that it was some sort of funeral rite, but then that wouldn't really be correct because we just don't know what they were doing. But it's also a good example of how that disease could be transmitted through the group.
Right. Now, and it's easy to fall into the trap of saying, well, then this is a great case of where, you know, nature abhors cannibalism, and that, you know, cannibalism of this nature, this, you know, communal cannibalism is just poison. And, you know, maybe, you know, you could still make that case, but, I was looking at a 2006, University of Virginia study, and they found that cannibalism, is actually only documented as the predominant transmission mode, of a disease in very few species. Yeah, even through, you know, specific instances of cannibalistic transmission, that have been noted. Like basically, the only two cases they found were the prion transmission
right.
in humans that we mentioned earlier and a kind of protozoa, based, illness in lizards.
Oh, right. Yeah. And do you think this is because most cannibalism is one-on-one as opposed to a group situation? Like the group cannibalism is more of an outlier?
And also I think it also comes down to like cannibalism, like, you know, a disease is going to needs to spread. It's got the same genetic mission as any organism.
Right.
So it needs a road it can count on, right? So the idea of some sort of disease depending exclusively on cannibalism, it largely doesn't make sense. It's
okay.
just not an economic way of going about it. For instance, in this study, in other cases of cannibalistic disease transmission, and there were others, alternate disease transmission modes existed. So it's like the, you know, hepatitis or something. Hepatitis isn't depending exclusively on group cannibalism to spread, but if that door's open, it'll gladly take it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Not to personify the illness too much.
No. So I guess that talking about not trying to anthropomorphize, ultimately you can't get back around to this question. Aren't we sort of all cannibals on some level or another?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at things like, you know, anything from a blood transfusion to, you know, organ transplant. I mean, it again kind of comes down to, the energy, situation. It's like we're taking energy out and storing it. We're harvesting energy that is otherwise going to be wasted and bringing it back into ourselves.
Yeah.
There are a few interesting cases in traditional Chinese medicine where you have, what they call Taibo. That's Taibao. Nothing to do with,
The martial arts exercise.
Yeah,
videos.
Nothing to do with that. But this is a particular medicine that involves something also referred to as abortus because it's harvested from fetuses. And this is according to Mary Roach in her book Stiff. She goes into this a little and explores this whole chapter on cannibalism and the use of materials from corpses in medicine in that book. So I highly recommend checking that out.
Yeah, and there's regenerative medicine too, basically taking tissue to grow new tissue.
Right.
You know, so I don't know. Chew on that, I suppose.
Yes, indeed. So hey, if you want to learn more about this, again, check out Josh Clark's article, How Cannibalism Works. It's great. It's a multi-page feast, and you'll want to eat up every page of it. And come check us out on Twitter and Facebook, where you can find us as Blow the Mind. And indeed, I encourage you, if you're a fan of the show, check out that Facebook page and click the like button. You'll make us very happy.
Yeah, that would be great. And if you've got thoughts on cannibalism, you can also email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.